Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pop Health Podcast. My name is Zach Morgan. I'm the host of Pop Health Podcast. I am here this morning in beautiful West Covina, California, actually not far from where I grew up in Upland. And I'm very lucky today to have Senator Ed Hernandez on as a guest. I actually had the pleasure of seeing Senator Hernandez speak at the at a conference recently, just before the election. And things were up in the air a bit at that point, just with the unsure nature of the election. And now, obviously, we know the results and some of the things that are changing a lot. But I was really excited to have you on, regardless of the outcome, because you were talking about a lot of really innovative things and some exciting ideas. So thank you so much for being on with me today, Senator.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
So one thing we always like to do to start off is, can you tell our guests something that people might not know about you, maybe non-work related that people might not know about you?
Well, aside from being a state senator, obviously I'm an optometrist, practicing optometrist, but I have two incredible daughters. I have a beautiful wife of 31 years, and what we like to do on the weekends is spend time with our kids and or ride bikes.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
And just so that people know, what is your district here as a state senator? What area do you serve?
So it's the 22nd Senate District. Each state senator represents just under a million people, because there's 40 million divided by 40. Mm-hmm. And it's primarily the heart of the San Gabriel Valley.
Okay, excellent. You had mentioned that you're an optometrist. What originally drove you to medicine?
You know, I've always been really good at math and science. I decided to apply to the various schools. I found optometry to be the most intriguing. Graduated from Indiana University School of Optometry, ended up coming back home and opening a practice in 1986, and we still have a practice there. My wife's an optometrist as well. Met her in optometry school.
Yeah. So do you still get to practice?
Yes, very, very little. As you know, being a state legislator and having a full-time legislature, I'm in Sacramento pretty much full-time, but I am on legislative break at the end of each calendar year. And when I'm on break, when one of our optometrists goes on vacation or my wife wants to take a couple days off, she makes me work.
Yes. And one thing that I think I had read, but just in doing research, you actually went to Fullerton here also, right?
Yeah.
To Cal State Fullerton.
Went to Cal State Fullerton.
Yeah. So you're from this area then that you serve?
Grew up, born and raised here, went away for graduate school, came back and opened a practice here and have been here ever since.
Yeah. Well, and we're going to get into it a little bit more about the things that you've been able to do in your time in public policy. But do you think that your practice as an optometrist and it being in the medical field has shaped some of the things that you've done in public policy or helped shape some of that?
Very much so. And obviously, that's the reason what led me to run. I didn't go to school to be a poli-sci major, wasn't, you know, involved in campaigns at an early age, and got involved in politics late in life. Got elected, was lucky enough to be chair of the Senate Health Committee right smack dab in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and, you know, have a hand in shaping the policy for that state of California.
Yeah. And so you actually touched on something I wanted to learn a little bit more about. What drove you to public policy in the first place? What made you decide that that was a path you wanted to take rather than pursuing just optometry?
You know, being an advocate in the community, getting engaged, I saw very early on the effects that our healthcare system had on my patients, especially the poor, uninsured. Mm-hmm. And I started to be an advocate in Sacramento and got the political virus and ran for office, and here I am.
And what was your first position that you held?
So I ran for the state assembly in 2006, got elected, and started serving in 2007, and in 2010 got elected to the state Senate.
Yeah. And you had mentioned that you chair the Senate Health Committee. Mm-hmm. Our audience is mostly healthcare professionals. Many of them, though, might not know exactly what your role is as the chair of that committee. Can you share a little bit about your role and how did you come to serve in that role?
Well, when I got elected to the Senate, I had requested that committee, and the pro tem at the time, which was Daryl Steinberg, was very gracious and allowed me to be chair. And as I said, when I became chair was literally when the implementation of the act occurred. And my role as chair is to look and take a position and make recommendations to committee members. And of course, they're going to vote however they wish, but to play a major role in all the policy dealing with healthcare in California, but more importantly, the healthcare policy that we decide make has impacts nationwide.
Right. Is it a requirement to be a physician to be on that committee or to chair that committee?
No, none whatsoever. As a matter of fact, there's very few healthcare providers in the state legislature. Okay. I believe it's myself, Richard Pan, who's a physician, Jim Wood, who's a dentist, and then there's a physician in the assembly, assembly member Arambula. So okay. There's just four of us, so there aren't very many.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm sure that it doesn't hurt to have a physician that chairs the committee. You had mentioned the Affordable Care Act. That's a big part of what we want to talk about today. You mentioned that you chaired the committee, right, kind of in the implementation part. Can you go into a little bit more detail about what your role was in either the creating the Affordable Care Act or implementing the Affordable Care Act? What was your role in the rollout of that?
So the federal law requires all the states to do several things. Number one, form an exchange and or use the federal exchange. California was one of the first states to have an exchange.
Right.
And all of the provisions in federal law have to be put into statute in state law. So being the chair of the committee, I had the pleasure and the honor of not only chairing, but more importantly, carrying those pieces of legislation. For example, all of the consumer protections that everyone has, I ran that law. The 10 essential health benefits, the Medicaid expansion, which now allows one-third of the population here in California to have Medi-Cal.
Right.
You know, various pieces of legislation for the actual implementation of the act.
Yeah. We had talked off mic just a little bit ago that I had the pleasure of interviewing the insurance commissioner, Mr. Jones, just some time ago. And he was talked about California forming its own exchange. I asked him about challenges with that. He mentioned that it was more opportunities. But what was your thought and why was it so important in your eyes for California to have its own exchange?
Well, California has always taken a leadership role in numerous issues, and in particular in the Affordable Care Act. When any state has embraced it, we've been successful and other states have been successful. But the pillar to the success for the exchange portion is the fact that we embraced it, we implemented it, but here's what makes California unique compared to other states. It's called an active purchaser. In other words, we have given direction that they have to make sure that they negotiate the absolute best prices for the consumer. They can compete amongst each other, the health plans, but more importantly, to make sure that the outcomes and the health outcomes are high as well.
Yeah. Well, so obviously there were unique set of opportunity and challenges. With California being such a large market, what were some of the largest challenges or some of the biggest challenges, either expected or unforeseen, that you faced in rolling out such a monumental policy?
The biggest challenges were the size of the population, number one, but more so was the diversity of the population.
Sure.
Languages, cultural differences. We had to put out ads in Spanish, in English, in, you know, Cantonese and Taiwanese and, you know, various ethnic groups. We not only had to market in the Central Valley, in the along the coastal area, in large cities. These markets are so varied and wide. That was the absolute most difficult challenge. The other challenge is we had no idea how many people were going to sign up.
Right.
And we anticipated there was going to be a lot. Well, guess what? That number, they blew way past that.
Right.
There was many, many more lives that were going to be signed up than we ever expected. That was the biggest challenge.
Yeah, and I can only imagine. It seems like one of those things that you can prepare until you're blue in the face and still just not even fully know what you're walking into. So I can only start to understand what that challenge must have been. Why do you believe in the Affordable Care Act?
Well, first of all, I believe that every single person in this country should have access to care, everyone. And living in the United States of America, an industrialized country, the most powerful country in the world, we didn't have that up until this point. And the Affordable Care Act is a step in that process.
Right. And it does seem And we'll get into it a little bit more, but it seems like it is, there had to be a step taken somewhere. and it does seem that for faults it may have, that it was a positive step towards something that was needed there. However, the incoming administration has obviously made it clear that repealing the Affordable Care Act is one of, if not the top priority that they have as they're assuming office. In fact, when this podcast airs, they probably will have assumed office at that point and may already be on the way to making good on that promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Unfortunately, for the most part, they've really been unable to propose viable alternatives so far. There was actually a new poll just recently, I think, from the Kaiser Health Foundation, that actually, even though people may have some issues with the Affordable Care Act, that most people would rather not see it repealed without some sort of alternative in place. Do you feel that a repeal of the law without a viable alternative is dangerous?
Extremely dangerous. I think it would send us back into the Stone Ages. If they completely repealed it and took away the funding for states like California, you'd have millions of people without health insurance. We'd go back to the days where they would wait to get care at the last minute, go to the emergency room and get the most expensive care. The dilemma that we have in the political process is that healthcare has always been controversial.
Sure.
And with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, more so. The Republicans have always introduced bills to repeal it. And I kind of use the analogy that it's sort of like the dog that has been chasing the car. They finally caught the car, and they don't know what they're going to do with it.
Right.
They have been introducing repeal, one year after year after session. Now that they actually have the authority to do it, they have no idea what they're going to replace it with.
Right. And there's been a lot of talk of repeal and replace, repeal and delay. And it's, I know this is a little bit kind of off what we were talking about, but do you have sort of any indication of, do you think that they may say it's repealed while they're, and then do the delay process and try to roll something out there? Or, you know, it seems just so dangerous just to get rid of it right away. I guess what I'm trying to get at, without being speculative, is how concerned should people be that with a repeal without an option, that they might lose coverage or be unable to get insurance again if they have a pre-existing condition? It seems like it's a very real concern, but is that something that people should be legitimately concerned about?
They should. They should be very, very concerned, because if we repeal this without a replacement, you will have individuals that won't be able to get health insurance. If we get rid of the individual mandate, for example, if you get rid of the pre-existing conditions, you're now going to have individuals that won't be able to qualify for health insurance. If you get rid of the Medicaid expansion and any of the federal money that comes with it, you're going to have millions of people in the street without health insurance like we did in the past. And it would be horrible.
Right. I had talked with the insurance commissioner about the waiver program and what a disaster that could be for a state like California that has just such a huge patient population, consumer population on Medi-Cal. But one other thing that has been thrown out recently has been, and excuse me, I'm probably going to say it wrong, but some sort of a health savings program. I'll be honest, even I don't necessarily understand fully the ins and outs of what that might mean. Could you clarify for myself and also for the listeners, sure, what does that mean? What is that?
So there's various proposals. The first proposal, if you look at Medicaid, the dollars that come to the states, they're looking at block grants. That would be very, very bad for California because it wouldn't take into account inflation. We already get very little money from the federal government, you know, regardless. The other thing they're looking at is vouchers and or tax credits. Okay, well, that might be good, but the amount of tax credit may not cover the cost of the premium dollar. So if somebody's poor and having to decide between buying food and buying health insurance, they're going to pay for food or
right,
pay for rent. With a health savings account, you know, somebody that's poor doesn't have the ability to put money into a health savings account to be able to get tax credits for it.
Right.
At the end of the day, I think the proposals that they're putting forward are going to benefit people with means. And unfortunately, the healthcare system we have, the people that don't have means, the poorest in this country, are not going to be treated fairly. That's right. the difference.
Right. I was actually surprised to learn how many people are supported through federal grants to help supplement the cost of their health insurance, and what a danger it could be to reduce that, let alone get away with do away with that money. The other thing I was kind of surprised to learn about, as I've been trying to learn about the savings account, is that there also could be restrictions on what kind of health delivery or services that you could actually use even money that you had put into your own health savings account for. But it does seem as though it leans towards, as you said, people with means that aren't necessarily the people who have benefited the most from implementation of such a monumental piece of policy. So I guess, obviously, the federal government is a huge entity. California, you said it earlier, things that happen in California make waves because of how big we are and how influential the state is. So what can or will you and other California legislators be able to do to continue to fight for California consumers?
Well, first of all, what we're going to do is we're going to make sure that we educate the new administration. We lobby for the protection of the current Affordable Care Act to require that they let us know what they're going to, if replace it with, what is it going to be. But I also think the absolute most important thing is to let the federal government and the new administration know that the federal dollar is extremely important. If they take that away, that this healthcare system will collapse in California. It'll affect, you know, millions of individuals and consumers and voters and individuals who live here in the state of California. The other thing we have to do is we have to build coalitions. We have to build coalitions with not only individuals and stakeholders, from doctors to hospitals to health plans to consumer groups in California. We have to build coalitions throughout the entire country, and we have to reach out to like-minded states, including states like Republican governors that have voted for the Medicaid expansion,
right,
to be able to give that message to Washington and the new administration, to let them know that, look, this is going to affect your constituents. The vote you're going to take is going to affect their health. This is a serious issue, and we need to make sure that we come together as a country and explain this to the new administration.
Right. I do sometimes feel that that's, I guess, for me, one of the frustrating parts about the dialogue around the Affordable Care Act is that so much of it seems so doomsday-ish, and it's hard to get the success stories out and how successful it's been. Do you feel that the first few years have been an overall success? Obviously, there have been bumps in the road. I don't think that any piece of legislation this influential and this big would be without that. But do you think the first few years have been successful?
They have been extremely successful, especially in California. And I think the biggest difference is those states who have embraced it have been successful. Have there been bumps? Yes. At the beginning, we underestimated the number of people. We didn't get enough registrations of Latinos and communities of color. We have worked our way through it, but it has been extremely successful, and the federal dollar has been extremely helpful to implement the Affordable Care Act and access to care for these individuals.
One thing that we had talked about is maybe being able to put a face on some of the success. You're a physician yourself. Do you have any specific success stories that people might hear that kind of humanizes the success that it's been so far?
Lots of success stories. You had asked me earlier if I still practice optometry. I do, on a very limited basis when I'm on break. One of my most recent breaks, I believe just last year, I was filling in for one of our optometrists, and a patient came in, and this is kind of typical of what I've seen post-Affordable Care Act. It was a gentleman in his mid-50s. The only reason why he came into the office, because he failed his DMV test to get his driver's license. He thought he needed glasses. So when he came in, we did a health history, we took a look at his retina, and we realized that the problem he had was not necessarily due to a change in his vision, but due to diabetes.
Wow.
He was diabetic. And I asked him, when was the last time you saw a physician, a dentist, anybody? He had never seen one within the last 10 years.
Wow.
I asked him why. He said he couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
I said, did you do you have a family history of diabetes? He said, yes. Do you realize that you have diabetes and that's what's affecting your vision? And he didn't know that. So we immediately got him in to see his primary care doctor, got his blood sugar stable, his vision returned back. We didn't have to prescribe glasses and was able to get his driver's license. But here's an individual that, had he not had health insurance, would have not utilized the system, possibly could have got into some kind of diabetic coma, ended up in the emergency room, and would have utilized the healthcare system in the absolute most expensive way. These are stories are, you can hear them over and over again because of the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah. In your position as a public figure, do you get to hear lots of stories like that from constituents?
Quite a few. As a matter of fact, the number of individuals who now have health insurance who've never had it, have Medi-Cal. And going back to your comment about the exchanges, in California, over 90% of individuals who are purchasing through the exchange have some type of subsidy and help that'll make it affordable for them to buy health insurance.
Yeah. I have someone who's very close to me that was diagnosed with very early onset thyroid cancer. And she was diagnosed with it. It was already in stage three. And she was with an employer that wasn't able to offer health insurance. And it was just before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And with the passage of the act, she was able to get coverage for the ongoing treatment of her thyroid cancer when she had had to pay for the procedure out of pocket because she hadn't been able to get on the exchange yet. And it was a lifesaver for her. And it didn't, now she's not saddled in an incomprehensible amount of debt just from ongoing medications and treatment, and she was able to get health insurance. And so I guess for me, that's why I like hearing the individual stories, because I think people sometimes think of it as this kind of fake entity, you know, this thing in the sky, but it has real life impact for a lot of people. So
a lot of real life impact for millions of people throughout this country.
Yeah. So in my other life outside of the podcast, I work a lot in senior care. One thing too that we've heard a lot about the Affordable Care Act is that it's actually already extended the solvency of Medicare, which people know is running out of money. I don't think that that's necessarily a point of contention. Can you explain that for people who might not understand what that means?
Yeah. So when the Affordable Care Act was put into law, there were a lot of provisions to have like different types of grants, but more importantly, programs to figure out how you can reduce and control healthcare costs and provide better healthcare outcomes. For example, like an ACO, Accountable Care Organization, best practices. A lot of those have shown great responses to consumers, to controlling healthcare costs, to be able to keep people healthier. So because of the Affordable Care Act, we've been able to provide that to the federal government and Medicare.
Yeah. We work a lot in the senior industry, obviously, with some of those things. There was actually some of the first research coming out on the mandatory bundles for lower extremity replacements that showed an average of about 8% cost savings, and sometimes as high as 30%. Just because of increased collaboration, ability to pick appropriate levels of care. On the professional side, that's part of what worries me about kind of this repeal without a plan option two, is that it's actually making a huge business impact as well. Beyond the personal health stories, the business impact has been quite large. And Tom Price, the incoming nominee for Health and Human Services, has been vocal against some of those mandatory bundles, for better or for worse, but it's worrisome on the professional side too about what the future of some of those things might look like. Right. So you were talking about Cover California and the success that it's been. You actually recently tweeted that there was a 4-day period in December that almost 70,000 people signed up for insurance just over that 4-day period through Cover California. Unfortunately, with the exchanges, the rising cost of premiums has been garnering a lot of press. As I mentioned, I recently had the insurance commissioner on. We talked about how some parts of the premium market are based on distribution of healthy and unhealthy people. It does seem, though, that a lot of that is due with the ever-rising costs of healthcare and how that is passed on to consumers. How are you able to use your platform on the Senate Health Committee to combat some of those rising costs?
So if you look at healthcare and how I mentioned earlier that it's been controversial and something's going to change, I don't know what the future of healthcare is going to look like, but there's one thing that is not going to change, whether you call it Obamacare, Republican care, whatever. The one constant that's not going to change is that the consumer is going to demand lower prices for their healthcare.
Right.
We have escalating healthcare costs. The one thing that the Affordable Care Act has done fairly well is it's been able to control costs through legislation, through federal law, as well as state law. I'll give you an example. Insurance companies have what's called medical loss ratio, which means they can only profit a certain percentage. If they profit above that, the rest goes back to the consumer. Providers, the rates are constant. There's pressures to keep them low. Hospitals, pressures are put to keep them low. There's one segment of the healthcare market that has absolutely no pressures whatsoever and is going unchecked, and that's the cost of prescription drugs. Prescription drugs is causing healthcare premiums to go up. And I'll tell you, if the federal government doesn't do anything, we are not going to control healthcare costs. And I don't care what you call it, whether it's Republicans or the Democrats or whoever. The platform that I have is to be able to voice the concerns of the consumers. And my number one priority is going to be to make sure that, obviously, we make sure that everybody has access to healthcare, but that they have affordable prices for their products. We're going to make sure we're going to take tough positions on increasing rates. But more importantly, we're going to introduce legislation like we did last year to have transparency to drug prices. It's very, very important.
Right. And actually, you led directly into what I wanted to ask you about. So the legislation you were referencing is that Senate Bill 17.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That's
and
correct.
It's transparency on drug prices. Is that correct? Can you elaborate? Can you explain to us what SB 17 was?
Sure. So there's very little that a state can do because manufacturers of drugs, they have patents, which are federal patents. And essentially, when they get a patent on a drug, which I'm saying it's very important, but they can have a monopoly, and right. they could charge whatever they want. So from our perspective, we need to find out, number one, what are the cost and the actual cost driver and the percentage of that dollar that goes to the premium so that we can look year over year and have some transparency. And it's proven that through transparency, the markets will naturally stabilize and will control costs.
Sure.
If you think about healthcare as a product, as a consumer product, when somebody goes to the doctor, no one has any idea what their costs are going to be. For example, when you purchase a car or you go online to buy something, you can price compare and look at. And we need to look at what the cost of our healthcare is going to be, but more importantly, the outcomes. And I think transparency is extremely important, and that's where the state of California can play a big role in making sure that there's some transparency, some drug pricing.
So what would the kind of ultimate success story of SB 17 be? Would it be that inflated prices, the transparency that comes with that then leads to lower costs? Or what is kind of what would you say would be a success for the bill?
Well, first of all, the success of the bill would be to have true transparency on drug prices, to find out where the cost is, number one, but also to predict and look at what the actual percentage of that goes towards the premium dollar.
Sure.
Once the consumer realizes that, then they can challenge the manufacturers. But also, the ultimate goal would be to stabilize healthcare costs, but more important, in particular, the cost of drugs in the United States.
Yeah, and that's an important thing that I wanted to touch on because you had mentioned earlier about what an influencer California is. Do you think that a success with this bill could be a blueprint for the rest of the country?
Very, very much so. And if you look at other states, there have been numerous states that have tried to implement similar types of laws. And there's kind of a movement or discussion about rising healthcare costs, and it's all zeroing in on prescription drugs.
Right.
The dilemma is that the pharmaceutical industry is extremely powerful and has a lot of money, and they spend a lot of money lobbying.
Right.
Last year, we introduced a bill very similar to the one we're going to do with SB 17, which they hired over 60 lobbyists just to kill that bill and to oppose it.
Right. Well, and I think it is interesting because, just like you said, the rising prescription drug costs, I think, is finally starting to get. I mean, just recently we had the whole EpiPen debacle and some others before that that have been really high profile national news. So hopefully bringing some transparency can then spread across the rest of the nation if California can prove that it works. You announced last year, actually, that your term is coming up, correct? In 2018, you'll have termed out of your position.
Correct.
And you had mentioned that you'll be running to succeed Gavin Newsom when his term is up as lieutenant governor. Why do you feel like you'd be the best person for that job? What interests you about that position that you could continue to carry on the work that you've been doing already?
Well, first of all, I love being a public servant, and I love serving the public because I like helping people, as I did as an optometrist as well. But the reason why I want to run for to become the constitutional officer and be the next lieutenant governor is I want to continue to work on healthcare, have a voice in workforce, try to provide more jobs to California. I want to be the advocate for California to go out to other states and maybe even abroad. But more importantly, if you look at our workforce in California and you translate it into healthcare, we have a workforce that doesn't reflect the demographics of the state. The lieutenant governor for the state of California sits on the UC Board of Regents, the CSU Board of Trustees, and I would have a voice on higher education. The other thing, too, is in order for California to be competitive in the future, we need to make sure we have an educated workforce. I'll give you an example. I voted for the $15 an hour wage, which was, I think, is something we should do. But one statistic that I found out that was very disturbing is that 30% of our population is making minimum wage. And it's ironic that 30% or a third of our population is a Medi-Cal as well. So if we're really going to excel in the economy in the future, we have to look at reducing the number of individuals on minimum wage, get better paying middle wage jobs, and educate our population. So if you have individuals that, if we can generate more bachelor's degrees, engineering degrees, more doctors, we're going to have individuals making significantly more, better tax base, paying back into the system. And I really believe by becoming lieutenant governor, it'll give me a voice to make sure that California succeeds in the future.
Well, I certainly wish you best of luck. It's been a real pleasure to get to talk to you today. Thank you for a really insightful back and forth and going through some of this. Do you think that you'll miss your time on the Senate Health Committee?
I definitely will. And the part that I will miss will have to play a part in history with the implementation and hopefully with the success and a continuation of it, but more importantly, to voice that the reason why we need to continue to have health care for this state.
Yeah. Well, I wish you the best in whatever is to come with the Affordable Care Act and in the next couple of years, and also then in 2018. I had the pleasure of hearing Gavin Newsom speak. My younger brother graduated from San Francisco State, and Gavin Newsom gave the commencement address. And he's a very dynamic speaker, so I think that you'd be an excellent successor to that position. So thank you so much for being on with me. Thank you all so much for listening to Pop Health Podcast. As always, you can find us on iTunes. Soon, I do believe we're also going to be on Stitcher, so people with Android phones can also download the podcast. You can always find us online, pophealthpodcast.com. I'm on Twitter at pophealthzach, that's Z-A-C. And Senator, your Twitter handle?
It's at Dr. Ed Hernandez.
At Dr. Ed Hernandez. Senator, thank you so much for coming on and being able to speak openly and freely about some of this stuff. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.